Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Royal Robins, The American Climber, by David Smart, narrated by Brian P. Craig. Publisher's note: this audiobook contains references to material present in the print and e-book editions of the book. One must have heroes, which is to say, one must create them. And they become real through our envy, our devotion. It is we who give them their majesty, their power, which we ourselves could never possess. And in turn, they give some back. But they are mortal, these heroes, just as we are. James Salter. Foreword. When I was a sophomore in high school and wannabe rock star, I'd often wander through the backpacker shop in Claremont, California, eyeing all the rock gear I couldn't afford just yet, wondering how I'd ever learn to use it once I could. That's when I saw the poster for Mountain Paraphernalia, featuring a trim Royal Robins. Manicured beard, creased knickers and red knicker socks, a white hat that I equated for some reason with British Formula One drivers, pasted on a vertical rock face what appeared like a mile off the deck. I still remember the rush of seeing that photo. As I imagined myself on that rock face, my heart redlined and I had to brace myself against the wall of the shop. I wanted to be Royal Robins so badly I could have screamed. Royal Robins, 1935 to 2017, marched point for the Yosemite pioneers during the golden age of American rock climbing, the 1950s and 60s, when the valley's granite walls were first descended. Several factors conspire to make him a historical figure. First, the venue for Robins' most notable ascents. Yosemite Valley, crown jewel of the National Park Service with over 3 million annual visitors. Immortalized by John Muir and the early paintings of Albert Bierstadt and Thomas Moran, by photographer Carlton Watkins and later Ansel Adams, whose words and images burned Yosemite into world consciousness. Then, the iconic granite monoliths like El Capitan and Half Dome, which, along with the waterfalls, are Yosemite's main attractions. The thought of climbing those walls strikes terror in the hearts of tourists who gape up from the meadows, enveloped in a timeless awe, wondering what sorts of mad people dare such heights. And finally, the era, when an entire generation chased the last unknowns. The 1950s and 60s saw space exploration go from sending a dog into orbit, 1957, to landing a man on the moon, 1969. Meanwhile, on Earth, Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary summited Everest, 1953. In 1957, Robins, Jerry Galwas and Mike Sherrick bagged the first ascent of the regular northwest face of Half Dome. The following year, mighty El Capitan fell to Warren Harding, Wayne Merry, George Whitmore, and Rich Calderwood. These two ascents, arguably the first genuine big walls climbed in the United States, thrust Yosemite to the forefront of rock climbing and kick-started the adventure sports movement. Even more than what they did, Robins and the Yosemite pioneers are legends for what they began, namely the ever-growing outdoor recreation market. Yet, in today's age of fleeting Instagram stars and a splintered climbing community in which distinction hinges on our differences, even Robins, titan that he was, is known mostly as a historical footnote. Who looks back these days? It's always been that way. When I first stumbled into the valley as a 17-year-old nobody in the early 70s, I knew and cared little about Robbins the person. I would later work for the man, if only briefly. I only wanted to bag the giant rocks Robbins and the Yosemite pioneers had packed into the pipe dreams of all of us wannabe rock stars. Only later, when I could view my Yosemite experience in a wider context, did I appreciate the gravity of the past and how even the greatest among us, then and now, are still orbiting Royal Robbins. The warp and weft of Robbins' life is lyrically described by David Smart as only a skilled biographer can do. But over the decades since I first tracked Robbins' footsteps, his sway over me has reached far beyond the granite walls we shared in common. Robbins' early years were the train wreck that often breeds felons and drunks. Luckily for R.R., he found climbing, a way out of his hard-scrabble youth, and he threw himself at the rock with abandon. As his climbs got harder, so increased the commitment, risk, and fear. Perhaps during his second ascent of the north face of the Sentinel, he and his partners were still teenagers, in 1953, or 4 years later on the first ascent of the regular northwest face of Half Dome, Robbins realized the great truth that Viktor Frankl had discovered during his captivity in Nazi concentration camps. As Frankl wrote in Man's Search for Meaning, which details his ordeal, when a person has a reason to live, they can face almost any travail. Such an approach, commonly born from trials by fire, goes directly against our instinctual response to avoid pain and seek pleasure and security. Problem is, we all have an expiration date, which leaves us wondering what anything means. Since our aversion to suffering runs so deep, few come to know, as an existential fact, that purpose and meaning accrue from facing difficulties, all while exploring what we can bring to the adventure. Not easy. Life happens. Dreams unravel. Friends and family drop away as we hurtle toward the vanishing point. And that's where Royal's legacy has paid the richest dividends. Learning that we are strangely saved by meeting life on its own terms, embracing the whole catastrophe, and discovering what grit and passion we can muster for the task. Remembering that, in any set of circumstances, no matter how grave, we can follow Robbins' example and choose our own way. Anything less leaves us underutilized. There are Rubicons that Robbins likely never crossed, which Smart brings into sharp, sometimes painful focus. A thorny aloofness plagued the man, which he escaped, if ever, only within his nuclear family. Nobody gets it all. But there's every sign that Robbins lived and died by his own lights, choosing his own way, often the path of greatest resistance, to explore and confirm who he was and what he had. That's why he's Royal Robbins. That's why he marched point, opening the route for the rest of us to follow. That's why his story is not solely for the outdoor crowd, but for all of humanity. John Long, March 2023. A Note on Sources. This book was written after extensive research. I reviewed Royal's own writings, both published and unpublished, including journals. Existing publications like the American Alpine Journal and Summit, correspondence between Royal and his peers, and extensive interviews with Royal's family and friends. Unless noted otherwise, in all cases where someone said something, the quoted material comes directly from an interview I conducted. In all cases where someone wrote something, the source is either cited in the body text Or, in cases where further clarification was needed, there is a citation in the notes section, which can be found in the print and ebook versions of this book. 1. Ride the Trail in Style. A man in a white hat has been making his way up the 3,000-foot granite face of El Capitan for 5 days, a wall no one has ever climbed alone. The muir wall had been ascended a few years earlier by men he knows, men driven into a state of ascetic reverie on the first descent by the difficulty and isolation, men who could live on 10 raisins a day. His means of ascent is pitons hammered into cracks. Where he is at the moment, the crack is thin and leaning, tucked away in a stone corner, a dihedral. He stretches up toward a section that looks wider and stuffs a tiny piton into the crack. As he reaches for his hammer, he utters a stream of puns and quotes from Emerson, Tolkien, and the French existentialists. He belts out songs as they float to the surface of his consciousness, listening like a piano tuner for the right note when steel meshes with granite. He taps on the piton, sweating even though it's 50 degrees and windy. The piton doesn't ring true, but he has no choice. He clips a webbing atrier to it, feeds a foot of rope through the thin prusik sling he uses to shorten his rope, and stands up in it. The piton tears free with a tiny grinding whine, and he falls into the 2,500 feet of space below. Before he has time to think, he smashes into the rock, the rope tied around his waist crushing his belly. His heart hammers against his ribcage. He hates falling, but always forces himself to keep climbing until he does. Checking to see that he is still wearing his hat, he straightens his glasses and looks up to where his piton tore free. His friends say that through those black plastic spectacles, he sees the wall differently than they do. He refers to himself as an unstoppable demon, a glutton for rock, but now he faces a problem. He cannot make a piton work where others have. El Capitan is a stadium, and he is its star. People who know his views, who look up to him, are watching from the meadow below. It would be the same at any cliff in the U.S., France, or the United Kingdom. He is their champion, a legend. The only option is to drill a hole and place a bolt, a practice he abhors. A paint salesman and high school dropout, he sees things when he looks up that few have contemplated. His own death, potential climbing routes where others see only blank stone. He sees the rock as something whose beauty will persist long after climbers have gone. A bolt would besmirch it, a mark of human shame because his friends have climbed past here without it. But there is no one to rescue him. No way off but up. In the early morning of February 3, 1935, Mason County, West Virginia, lay under weeks of snowfall. The temperature in the silent streets of Point Pleasant was minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit. In the rented second floor of a small house on the outskirts, 20-year-old Beulah Bowen was in the midst of a protracted, painful labor. "It's a pity," said one of the midwives, "she has to die so young." But the scars on Beulah's torso from a childhood accident with a gas heater showed her resilience. She would survive her labor, as would the child. Beulah named her son Royal Shannon Robbins after her husband, who went by Shannon. Royal later described his given name as a lower-class Irish ploy. But his father came from a brood of unusually named progeny, including brothers Loring and Marvel and sister Winota. Royal's paternal grandfather, John Robbins, was a stonemason who knew the textures and smells of granite and discovered how it cooperated with his chisel. He is most remembered for the poetic act of carving his own tombstone. Stone offered the poor an outlet for the pharaonic urge to leave traces, to come to terms with the brevity and uncertainty of life. Shannon's name was likely borrowed from a popular schoolbook author, and he hoped to be a writer like his namesake, but his folk were Appalachian workers who could write little more than their own names, instead passing down detailed family trees and oral history. Shannon left school at 6 and learned to write by cribbing from books. When he wasn't reading, he liked to fight and became the state welterweight boxing champion. Early in 1934, Shannon sauntered into the drugstore where Beulah worked in Gallipolis, on the Ohio side of the eponymous river. He was 2 years older than her and did odd jobs at a garage, but she was intrigued by his manners, movie star mustache, and sad smile. The attraction was mutual, and they married in the minister's house on July 3rd. Shannon was a poor excuse of a husband. He drank to excess, smashed the furniture in fits of rage, and had affairs. He threatened to burn Beulah's clothes if she followed him to one of his lover's houses, and made up stories about a twin brother who had been killed in a brawl and whose assailants he claimed to have murdered. Worse, he seemed to believe his own lies. After 2 years of marriage, Beulah decided that she and Royal had a better chance of surviving without Shannon, so she threw him out. The following January, the Ohio River flooded the streets of Point Pleasant, and many people drowned or died of hypothermia. The water rose nearly to the second story, Royal wrote in his journal, where my mother waited in terror, holding me tight. My father was elsewhere. He was often elsewhere. Beulah, whom Royal described as radiant in her purity and innocence, was his refuge, guarding him from the cold, dark waters. Beulah met James Jimmy Lee Chandler the next year, and they fell in love. Soon, Royal and his mother moved to Chandler's hometown of Mansfield, Ohio. When they married, Beulah took his last name and used it for the rest of her life. Chandler changed Royal's name to Jimmy Chandler because he thought Royal sounded too highfalutin, and he wanted Royal to seem like his son. And although Royal's father was legally entitled to object, no one knew his whereabouts. Chandler soon proved little better than his predecessor. Employers fired him after a few days because he was argumentative and often drunk. The family lived off the wages Beulah made at a drugstore. One evening when Royal was 5, he refused to go to bed, and Chandler whipped his bare buttocks with his belt until they bled. Royal claimed to have asked for the punishment, as if to take back agency from Chandler. To avoid further beatings, Royal accepted Chandler's fantasy that he was his father. For his own protection, Beulah sent Royal to live at Roy and Leota Probst's foster home for children. When he wet his bed, the foster home matrons held his face beneath the showerhead until he was half drowned. Without state oversight or even restrictions on punishment, they repeated the torture with impunity, but without results. Standing under the showerhead, Royal's pride and shame collided, and he discovered an unshakable inner composure. He began to pity the matrons who sought to break him by such feeble means. The emotional and physical blows of his childhood would be offset by an uncanny sense of invulnerability. In 1940, it became clear that the U.S. would soon be participating in the Second World War. Shannon Robbins and Jimmy Chandler filled out their draft cards. Beulah lost some hours at the drugstore because cosmetic sales had dwindled and wartime work to replace her wages was slow to come to Mansfield. Jimmy's older brother William had moved to Los Angeles with his wife Velma and owned a gas station on La Brea Avenue. Beulah and Jimmy decided to try their luck out in California, where every month the promise of wartime work drew thousands of hopeful survivors of the Great Depression. Their first stop was a clapboard rental near Pier Avenue in Hermosa Beach, steps from the roaring Pacific, the first and only thing Royal loved about the town. The ocean's enormity offered shelter to a boy who longed to escape an environment mismanaged by petty adults. He learned to let the currents carry him out and wash him back onto the beach, indulging a forbidden impulse to surrender, half terrified to the immeasurable power of nature. The birth of Royal's half-sister, Helen Penelope Chandler, Penny, on September 15, 1941, inspired Jimmy to spend a few days looking for work. But he soon found his new responsibility tiresome and retired to the bar. Royal became profoundly protective of Penny and remained so throughout his life. The sense of a world under threat from above was palpable in Los Angeles. Searchlights combed the skies for Japanese aircraft. Hundreds of Japanese balloons carrying incendiary devices drifted across the Pacific and landed on the West Coast. Bubblegum cards depicted the silhouettes of enemy aircraft. Comic books, chewing gum, and toys reflected an obsession with flight. America's most powerful hero, Superman, could fly without an aircraft, and in Royal's daydreams, so could he. As he wrote in My Life, To Be Brave, "Looking down, I could see houses here, trees there, and rivers and roads. My dream flying could occur only by dint of great effort. I flew not by grace or skill, but by pure force of will. I flew because I would." In this fantasy, his inner discipline, the resolve that defeated abuse and shame, overcame the limitations of his body, even of gravity itself. A boy with such an intense interior life was powerless against the attractions of the movies. When he was six, his favorite serial featuring Nyoka the Jungle Girl hit the screens. Nyoka Gordon, a crack shot, equestrian, rock climber, and judo expert, wore khaki shorts, a blouse with cartridge tubes sewn over the bust, and pistol holders. Her sidekick, an obvious surrogate for boy moviegoers, had a pet shoulder monkey and wore a similar uniform. Episodes usually climaxed with Nyoka and her scantily clad nemesis Voltura locked in hand-to-hand combat while Voltura's gorilla sidekick joined in or gesticulated on the sidelines. Thoughts of Nyoka haunted Royal. One night he dreamt Beulah was being attacked by Voltura's gorilla and woke up in a panic. He climbed out his window and convinced the neighbors to call the police to check on her. When the family moved to West Hollywood, Royal became a regular patron at the Western's only venue of the Hitching Post at Hollywood and Vine. On the silver screen, the heroic Western landscape with its mountains and colossal sandstone walls inspired character contests between heroes who slept right on the desert sand next to their campfires. Dale Evans, Royal's second movie crush after Nyoka, wore six-shooters, rode horses, and preferred the open range to domestic life. She was also the first outdoors person in Royal's life who didn't just ride the trail, but did it with style, a philosophy declared in the refrain to her signature song. In 1942, the Chandlers couldn't make rent and moved to a trailer park in Redondo Beach a few miles south. Kids welcomed Royal by shooting him in the back of the neck with an air rifle. Royal tried to prove his worth by standing behind a sign while a boy shot it with a bow and arrow. He stuck his head out at the last moment to show off, and the arrow struck him above the nose. The scar never went away. Despite his bravado, a certain sadness pervaded Royal's mien during those years. In a 1942 photograph, he salutes the camera in a costume uniform with a Sam Brown belt, looking worried and unsure. Royal rarely smiled in boyhood photos unless he was with Beulah. In 1944, the Chandlers again could no longer make rent and moved in with Jimmy's brother, William, William's wife, Velma, and their children. The contrast between Jimmy's struggling family and his brother's happy home drove Jimmy to drink even more. Arguments between Beulah and Jimmy became frequent and violent. One day, Jimmy called Royal a sissy after a girl beat him in an impromptu foot race. "Being called a sissy," wrote Royal, who as an adult never lost his respect for the athletic abilities of women, "was the worst thing in my life." Royal was no weakling, but neither was he especially fast or strong. He saw his body's failure, however, as just another limitation to overcome. His willfulness supplied him with a desperate kind of hope. Through her retail job, Beulah eventually made enough money to rent a house on the impoverished streets between the Hollywood movie lots, where America's dreams and nightmares were forged. Royal described their little house on Seward Avenue as decent, although their sleep was often interrupted by the bells at Fire Station 51 just across the street. It was a small price to pay for the opportunity to hang around the station, playing horseshoes and comparing the firemen to the two fathers in Royal's life. Kids in the family's new neighborhood played dangerous games. Royal destroyed his bicycle in a crash with another boy, stepped on a nail in an abandoned warehouse, battled kids from other streets on vacant lots, and trespassed through backyards not, as he recalled, to get to Santa Monica Boulevard, but to make the journey interesting. Beulah thought Royal needed more structure, and in 1944 she enrolled him in Wolf Cubs. The rules and ceremonies of the weekly meetings disheartened him. After he tried unsuccessfully to get a girl to notice him by wearing his cub uniform, he quit. Beulah often asked Royal to go down to Davy Jones's locker, a bar, and tell his stepfather to come home. When Jimmy ran out of drinking money, he would ask Beulah for a few dollars. Denied his liquor money, he became loud, sometimes even violent. One evening in 1945, Royal awoke to hear Jimmy and Beulah fighting. When his mother cried out, "Jim, put down that knife," Royal climbed out his window and ran to the Technicolor plant half a block away. By the time the police arrived with Royal in the patrol car, Beulah had escaped to the fire station and Jimmy had fled. Although Beulah then banned Jimmy from her life, he returned one night when Royal was alone. He produced a knife, not to threaten Royal, but to cut off his own finger to prove he had changed. Jimmy, Beulah would tell Royal, was at his worst on Seward Avenue. He left with all his fingers and soon after ended up in a mental health facility. A few years later, he died in a bar fight. In the summer of 1945, America defeated Japan. Beulah called Royal into her room and told him things he half remembered but had suppressed to make peace with Jimmy. For the first time in years, she spoke the name she had given Royal at birth. Beulah told Royal that his biological father, Shannon, had been a hunter, writer, and professional boxer. She told her son that now he could use his father's name. "I instantly knew I wanted to be like my father," Royal said. "I didn't want my stepfather's name. I could slough it off like a snake sloughs its skin." A proud son with a real father, Royal informally added Junior to his name when signing some of his letters.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?